So another section that continues to get attention is sort of this grab bag that we call portal hypertension, or things that I think we use as clinicians, ideas how to manage patients with advanced liver disease, portal hypertension. So this was a late breaking abstract, and again, I'll call this drug DAPA, dapagliflozin, and looking at the incidence of chronic kidney disease in patients who have metabolic dysfunction-associated steatotic liver disease or MASLD-associated cirrhosis in people who have ascites. So it's a mouthful, right? But we know that patients who have ongoing ascites in particular are at risk of AKI, CKD. And we have this massive group of patients with MASLD who have additional reasons to have CKD, including typically diabetes, hypertension, et cetera. So we recognize that MASLD cirrhosis is often complicated by renal dysfunction. However, we really don't have any ongoing strategies to try to reduce the risk. So this medication is an SGLT2 inhibitor, and in other patients has demonstrated renal protective effects in patients who do not have cirrhosis, but also improvements in metabolic parameters. And the authors felt potentially could aid in resolution of ascites in patients who had cirrhosis. So really looking at what happens in the patient population with cirrhosis treated with these medications. So this was really an early study to look at efficacy and safety in patients who had MASLD cirrhosis and moderate ascites. And the primary outcome was looking at the development of CKD within a 12-month period. So patients were randomized. This was open label, 144 patients. They were randomized 1:1 standard of care versus DAPA. DAPA was initiated at 5 milligrams and then increased to 10 milligrams, but standard of care was also continued in that patient population. And the primary outcome, again, was the development of CKD at a year. And the authors defined this as a sustained GFR less than 60 over a 3-month period at the endpoint of a year. So the results really showed a significant difference in the rate of CKD development. There was 8.3% of patients on DAPA developed CKD at a year as compared to 22.2%. So this was significant. And in addition, as a secondary outcome, there was improvement in ascites resolution as well, 75% of patients on DAPA versus 54% of patients on placebo, with a significant reduction in diuretic dose from 6 months onward. Other parameters that would potentially be affected by DAPA were stable across follow-up, and this included hemoglobin A1C, lipids, and CRP. There were some adverse events that tended to be mild, urinary infections. 4% of patients discontinued drug, but there was no episodes of fracture or hypoglycemia. So the authors really concluded that this drug could improve ascites control and reduce diuretic burden in patients without renal or metabolic compromise, and that it was really safe and well tolerated and could potentially be something that we could use in our patient population who has MASLD and cirrhosis. So I'd be interested, Nancy, to know sort of do you have a strategy in this patient population who typically, in many cases, they may have diabetes or hypertension. Do you have a strategy in this patient population and looking specifically toward CKD, or is it more a general strategy in terms of the metabolic parameters that these patients have?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing is to recognize that this is a group of individuals that's very high risk for complications. And if you are low MELD, we usually talk about TIPS. I think that if our patients are able to get a TIPS, tends to improve their nutritional status, help control their fluid, but not everyone is a great TIPS candidate. And I will freely admit that this did not make sense to me to cause glucosuria leading to improved renal effects, even though that's what they use this for in our patients with diabetes. And I did not expect glucosuria to lead to improved, this degree of improved ascites. I mean, you can imagine you're going to get a little bit of osmotic effect if you're peeing out a bunch of sugar, but I did not expect this. And I think this is important, especially in patients that, you know, not all of these individuals had diabetes. But if you look at someone that's a little bit older, and we know that TIPS, you know, is not a good choice in a patient with a risk of encephalopathy, or as you get older, if you're not a great transplant candidate, or you are a good transplant candidate, but a bridge with TIPS is not a good option for you. This looks very attractive. This is one of those take-home messages where I think, well, hey, listen, I should probably try this. I have never prescribed this class of drugs. We do a lot of GLP-1s. We do a lot of messages back to endocrinology about the importance of improving glycemic control. But I've never once thought about prescription of this. And I think that's going to change.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like I have to become partial nephrologist in taking care of patients with advanced liver disease, right? And understanding the effects of many medications on kidney function in association with and apart from liver disease, right?
Absolutely. And this is, you know, I've constantly harped on the fact that if you trained in your general internal medicine 30 years ago, you're still practicing with many messages from 30 years ago that are no longer appropriate. So, this is why we need to continue to do those refreshers, continue to learn about things outside of our area of expertise, not just to know what your patient's on, but also to, you know, become creative with use of other drugs. I think this was a really important study.
Yeah, I think your point is that there are drugs other than insulin. Is that your point?
Just a few.
So the next abstract was also a late breaker, allowing me to think more and talk a little bit more about albumin, because, it is something that I've talked about for 30 years in association with liver disease. But this was titled Short-Term Human Albumin Therapy Improves Serum Sodium Concentration and Reduces Mortality in Patients with Cirrhosis and Dilutional Hyponatremia. So this is a problem, right? Hyponatremia has been associated with a significant increased risk of morbidity and mortality in our patients with advanced disease, and hence why it was incorporated into the MELD score, MELD sodium, to reflect that risk. But we recognize it is common in our patients with decompensated liver disease and associated with high risk. And really, we have no effective therapies other than primarily fluid restriction, diuretic withdrawal, supportive care. This becomes very problematic in our patients who are called in for transplant, for example. But there has been some small studies. There have been a lot of studies on albumin, but suggesting in this case that albumin may be effective in improving serum sodium concentration. But again, no real randomized controlled trials. So this trial was really, it was called the ALBUCAT trial, multicenter trial. It was open label. 52 patients were randomized. All patients had a serum sodium less than or equal to 133, which is how they defined hyponatremia. So the treatment that patients were randomized to was intravenous albumin for a maximum of 10 days. They got a gram per kilogram for the first day, 40 grams per day following that, plus standard of care, which included fluid restriction and diuretic withdrawal. And they compared that to patients who received standard of care alone. The primary outcome was, in this study, resolution of hyponatremia. And again, the authors defined that as an increase in serum sodium of greater than or equal to 5 milliequivalents per liter with a final value of greater than 130. And then there were secondary outcomes as well of the frequency of resolution of hyponatremia, including partial resolution, and then liver-related complications and overall survival. So when you look at the compare, the group that entered, 52 patients, they were randomized, 25 received albumin, 27 standard of care. They were more frequently men, median age was 61. Most were alcohol related, about three quarters. Median MELD was 17, and median serum sodium was 128. Interesting too, though, that 17 patients, about a third, had severe hyponatremia less than 125. And so when you look at the primary endpoint, which was resolution of hyponatremia, relative risk of which favored albumin treatment was 3.39. The percentage of patients looked to be about 46% versus 20%, which was significant, favoring albumin. The secondary outcomes, again, although not statistically analyzed, 28-day mortality, there was no one who died in the treatment group. Five patients died in the control group. AKI incidence, six patients in the albumin group as compared to 15 in the control group, and very similar rates of adverse events between the groups as well. So at least in this study, which I think was a nice study to think about when we think about albumin use in our patients, short-term administration of albumin was associated with higher rates of resolution of hyponatremia, as well as what appeared to be a relative lower rate of mortality and reduced incidence of AKI as compared to standard of care. So we can talk a little bit about albumin. We've used this quite a bit, right? There have been a number of studies looking at albumin, in large part because albumin is always one of those markers of morbidity, mortality, right, in our patient population. So some studies have even looked at, well, let's try to make the albumin normal. Didn't seem like a really great idea when patients developed, you know, fluid overload. But it is important because we continue to use albumin. And how do you think of using albumin? What are your thoughts, Nancy?
Yeah, it's interesting that albumin is probably one of the most controversial treatment options that we have for this patient population. And I think the easiest is that we use albumin in a patient who has concern for AKI, whether it's AKI HRS or just AKI in a patient with cirrhosis. And so we use the albumin to kind of address that component of pre-renal. And I think the study suggests that many of these individuals, because hyponatremia is on that continuum of, you know, ascites, refractory ascites with hyponatremia, refractory ascites with hyponatremia and renal dysfunction, that you're capturing these HRS patients at an earlier time point. I also use albumin in patients with hypoalbuminemia to help with diuresis. So if you come in and you have significant anasarca and your albumin is like 1.9, even if your kidney function is fine, I use albumin to help my, you know, diuretics to be used more aggressively. You know, this population, 28-day mortality is important, but this is a group of individuals that's probably, you're looking at albumin as a bridge to transplant. Unless you have something reversible, this is a group of really sick individuals. And I think it would be interesting to see if patients that had that more severe hyponatremia, because I wouldn't give albumin to someone with a serum sodium of 132. I mean, that to me is not real hyponatremia in a patient with, you know, refractory ascites or ascites. But if you are capturing improvement in mortality in a group that has a serum sodium less than 125, I think that we would start to pull this into, you know, standard of care algorithms.
Yeah, I didn't really see that data in terms of just isolating that smaller group of patients with severe hyponatremia. But I think it's an interesting concept. You know, something to think about in our patient population, because again, the patients that we tend to hospitalize are not those with a serum sodium of 132. They're the patients with serum sodiums of 118 and 119 and pretty significant hyponatremia. But again, I think we are going to continue to use albumin in many forms for many things. So the next abstract was looking at efficacy and safety. Again, we're back to albumin for prevention of acute kidney injury and cirrhosis and high-risk SBP. So this was a randomized control trial out of India. We recognize that patients who have cirrhosis and SBP are prone to acute kidney injury, and our guidelines suggest that we give albumin for this purpose. And we also recognize in multiple ways that excessive albumin use can lead to volume overload, respiratory distress. So this was really a study where the authors were trying to look at the efficacy and safety of what they considered low dose versus conventional dose albumin for preventing progressive AKI or new onset AKI in a high-risk population. So this was one center, single center. Patients who were included those patients with cirrhosis, high-risk SBP. They had to have a bilirubin greater than 4 or a creatinine greater than 1. And they were randomized to either conventional albumin versus low-dose albumin. We can discuss whether their use of definition was conventional or low-dose, but 1.5 grams per kilogram for the conventional dose and 1 gram per kilogram on day 3 versus low-dose albumin, which was 1 gram on day 1 and 0.5 grams per kilogram on day 3. And again, the primary outcome by day 4 was AKI onset or progression of kidney injury. So there were 168 patients who were actually randomized in this single center, and median ages were similar. Most was alcohol in addition to MASLD. Most patients, 70%, were Child's PUC, and MELD scores were comparable, but pretty high, 24. And then when they looked at these outcomes, circulatory overload, which is, I think, one of the concerns that we always have with albumin, occurred significantly more often in the conventional group. Both on day 1, there were 82% of patients versus 32%, as well as on day 3, 87% versus 6%. New onset AKI rates were similar, so no difference there. However, patients who had AKI at presentation, progression occurred actually more commonly in the conventional group as compared to the low dose group. Mortality, SBP resolution was similar. So again, getting back to albumin and looking at what our standard of care has always been, whether it continues to be reasonable, low dose albumin in this study was non-inferior to conventional use, and there were significantly lower rates of infusion-related complications. So again, I think this is data, and we talk about it a lot with terlipressin. We've actually changed our protocol with terlipressin to more individualize albumin use as opposed to using any kind of standard treatment for all patients. What do you do, Nancy? Is there kind of a standard? Do you follow guidelines for albumin infusion for patients who have SBP, or do you more individualize it?
Well, we have a protocol. So, albumin is oddly one of the most debated things in our order sets. It has to get approval by a certain type of provider or a pharmacist if you are not an approved albumin prescriber. And because of that, we have this protocol that you really use as the 1.5 and 1 on day 1 and day 3. But just like you said, we don't follow that protocol in an individual who has significant volume overload, or let's say your serum albumin is 3.5. Now, that would be a little odd in a person who's presenting with a complication of end-stage liver disease, but we're not going to give a ton of volume in someone who's swimming away, is at risk for pulmonary edema, or where albumin, it does not look like it's going to be the answer. I'm fascinated. Like, this is a big study, right? I know it's a single center, but when you're looking at, over 150 individuals, I think we're able to say that this was a high enough number that we should believe this.
Yeah.
And I remember as a fellow repeatedly my mentor saying, you know, why are you doing this? And I'd be like, well, I mean, the guidelines of the article say to do this. And, you know, Anna May would say, well, where's the data that says that this is the correct dose? And, you know, as one of those individuals that was, you know, really told to be a follower, I'd go back and look and I'd be like, well, I don't know, someone just decided we should give that. And no one ever challenged if that was the right answer. And so, you know, thinking about the patient in front of you and the agent that you're using and someone who is very volume contracted, has, you know, renal insufficiency, has a history of hepatorenal syndrome, using a higher amount of albumin probably makes sense. Someone who looks more euvolemic or volume overloaded that presents with SPP, a lower amount of albumin probably makes sense. And so, you know, challenging those conventional norms is important for us.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think we need to always question, you know, dogma, right? Which I found very interesting presentation was Beacon, which is a portable at-home critical flicker frequency testing for minimal HE. So, you know, we've talked about critical flicker frequency for a long time. I've never seen it used. I've never used it myself. But again, we talk about it in our data sets as a means to diagnose HE. So this is interesting. This, again, there's a lot of technology being developed to try to use at home, both to monitor patients for HE, but also to predict HE in our patients with advanced liver disease. And so there has been a lot of interest in trying to develop something that you can take home and report electronically to physicians. So this Beacon allows at-home testing, and it uses a flickering light source and a smartphone application to control the device. And there were two flicker frequency protocols, neither of which I understand, which were descending and forced choice. But the study aim here, which I think is most important, was to look at the feasibility and reliability of repeated at-home a critical flicker frequency testing using this device. Participants received the device and a smartphone. The software was pre-installed, and participants were instructed to complete 5 or more tests using both protocols per week for the first 2 weeks, and then one test per week for at least 4 weeks. And the outcomes really in this case were to look at adherence to the protocol and the stability of the critical flicker frequency testing over time and how long it took to complete the test, which is going to be important if we're going to use it in our patient population. So there were 21 at-home study participants. And what they found were that 86% of the individuals did complete the full 6-week testing schedule, over 90% adherence to daily testing. So that was important to see as well. There was no learning effect. And that, I think that's important for any test that we're using to look for HE. Is there a learning effect? Do people get better at it? Which would, I think, decrease our ability to identify our target. And the average testing time was pretty reasonable, 2.5 minutes for the descending protocol and for 4.7 minutes for the forced protocol. And what was interesting is that the median values for those patients without HE versus those who had a history of HE was very different. So the CFF values for patients with no pre-existing history were much higher than those patients with a history of HE. And so I think this is one of many tools that we will start to utilize at home. But important here is that a tool that does have some validity, but is nearly impossible to use in the clinical arena, did demonstrate high patient adherence and stable measurements over time. And again, I think now looking at this data, hopefully one can start to use it more long term to see if it will help us identify the patient who may be worsening or potentially developing HE at home. So I don't know what I know you've read a lot about critical flicker frequency, and it's always something we talk about, and it's and how useful it might be, but that it will never happen in any of our clinics. So what are your thoughts, Nancy?
No, I think that this is great. You know, this is in that bucket of tools where we talk about formal, you know, testing. This is when you have a patient that you think might have minimal hepatic encephalopathy or subclinical hepatic encephalopathy, and you send them off to the neuropsychiatrist to get formal testing. This is one of those tools that we know that they might use, but we don't think we have the ability to use on our own. I think that this is, you know, if you imagine the Stroop app, which does have a learning curve, as being, you know, the iPhone 1, we should be challenged to look at other ways of identifying a patient who's at risk for encephalopathy at earlier time points. And there are so many wearables. There are so many, whether it's your Oura Ring or your iPhone, you know, your watch. We are going to find things, whether it's sleep quality or critical flicker frequency, that predict a person who has impending doom. And, you know, Jazz and I have talked before about, wouldn't it be nice if Alexa could give you the animal naming test every single day and not only assess your speech quality and how many animals you could come up with, but maybe, you know, where you're looking. I mean, there are so many ways of delegating these things that need to be done and need to be done repeatedly in ways that you don't have to have a patient come into clinic and you don't have to have family asking them stupid questions to identify if they're becoming less sharp. So I think this is great. Now, will patients do it to the degree to identify someone? I think that you're going to have fatigue, right? I would get tired of doing my critical flicker frequency test every day or twice a week for, you know, years. But it's certainly a great, you know, foreshadowing for things that we might have for these patients that do not want to run into their mailbox and present to the emergency room confused.
Yeah. I think one of the things that I find encouraging is the short time that it takes. I mean, if you're going to ask me to do something for 5 minutes, I'm not going to do that. If you're going to ask me to do animal naming, I'm going to write them down and read the list to you over the phone. So it is interesting, and I look forward to this and actually a lot of other, as you said, sort of home devices that we can utilize biometric measurements in some way to try to identify this patient population.
Well, but yeah, Kim, when we're testing you, I'm going to ask you things you find in the grocery store, items in your kitchen. We're gonna vary it for you, so you can't just write it down. If you find cats, dogs, and elephants in your kitchen, we know you're in trouble.
That's right.
Well, anyway. I want to thank everyone. This has been the Liver Lineup, Updates and Unfiltered Insights with Kim Brown and Nancy Rowe.